You're listening to the Shared Security Show, exploring the trust you put in people and technology with your hosts, Tom Esten, Scott Wright, and Kevin Johnson. Welcome to episode 247 of the Shared Security Show, and joining me this week is my one and only co-host, the real Scott Just Wright.
Just me this time.
Yeah, the real,
not
fake.
Not going skiing afterwards either.
Not so. Going skiing. Yeah, the real Scott Wright is here.
Yeah,
everyone, yeah. Welcome back.
Yes, and Kevin, the real. Today. Where's the real Kevin?
Well, the real Kevin is not feeling well today, so we're going to give him the week off.
That's
so
sad.
He can hopefully feel better. But so hopefully everyone saw the episode last week where we did our impromptu Halloween edition.
Yeah, that was fun.
It was fun. It was fun. Yeah. So check that out.
Yeah, but we're back to serious stuff now.
We are. Very serious stuff. And our first story was about the verdict in the Uber breach. This has generated, I'll just say, a lot of controversy in the cybersecurity community specifically. Yeah. Because Joe Sullivan, who is the former CISO over at Uber, and this is a situation that goes back to 2016 when they had a breach, and he's been accused of covering up that breach while he was the chief security officer at Uber. And he was actually convicted. An actual guilty verdict was issued, and he actually will probably spend time in jail. Obviously, he's going to appeal this, but this is obviously stirred up the security community in that this is the first case of an actual chief information security officer being accused of a crime and can actually serve jail time.
Which it is really, it's an interesting problem that, you know, it's going to take a long time to, I think, sort through, you know, in terms of trying to figure out what's the right answer for, you know, the legal liability. Because, you know, when it, you can almost think of it as equivalent to a chief financial officer, right? There's a lot of potential risk and liability that has to be managed in a responsible way. But the difference I see is that chief financial officers, everything is numbers, right? It's all discrete. You can say this happened or this didn't happen. With a security officer, you know, you're trying to fight, you know, invisible threats and you're trying to determine what do you need to have in place, you know, to counter these things. Now, that's assuming everything is above board, and you know, you can certainly question a CSO's motives and, you know, maybe their methods. But it is a lot more of a gray area, I think, than, you know, a lot of other C-suites.
Now, the thing I want to specify about this particular case was that he's actually been accused of obstruction of justice and lying to the government, basically.
Right. Yeah, that's what I meant when I said methods.
yeah. So he's not being accused of, you know, the data breach itself, right?
Like you didn't have enough firewalls. Yeah.
Yeah. You failed to protect the company, so you're going to jail.
Yeah.
This is really about him lying to the government about it, and it is pretty complicated because there are like they even talk about like the legal team knew about it as well, but they weren't involved in the prosecution. I mean, there's all these different weird things going on in this particular case, but I mean, my opinion, and I know Kevin and I have had this discussion that, you know, this could happen to anybody. If you lie to the government, you're probably gonna get in trouble.
Yeah.
So no matter who you are, right?
Happened to be a C-suite officer in a very, very visible, very important company.
And if you're in a leadership position and maybe a legal department or somebody else, maybe the CEO says, maybe you should try to cover this up. You should still report it because it's the right thing to do and not continue to cover things up. So, I think this is an interesting case. I don't think it is a, oh my gosh, everyone that's a CISO should freak out and, you know, now check your personal liability for.
Yeah, I think it did bring attention, you know, what CISOs are going to jail. Yeah.
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 It did.
Yeah.
But as someone had said on LinkedIn, play stupid games, win stupid prizes, right?
That's one way to put it. Yeah,
that is one way to put it. So
yeah,
so we'll obviously be following this closely. This that I'm obviously going to be appealed and all of that stuff before, you know, this gentleman serves jail time. But it's pretty serious. I mean, he could I think they said the sentence could be up to 8 years in prison. So that's no joke.
It is. It's pretty serious. And, you know, I think the serious part of the discussion, too, is not just about the fact that, you know, they decided to cover the things up. It's really think about this, the slippery slope that you're on when you're talking about, you know, communicating or publicizing vulnerabilities. Right. You know, how we've talked about this before on the show, you know, at what point do you publicize a vulnerability and not have, you know, liability, right? So this could eventually play into this kind of story as well. So, you know, if you get used to not disclosing vulnerabilities, then what else might you hide, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, let's go into our favorite segment, and that is Aware Much.
Aware Much. Yes. Thanks, Tom. Well, today we're going to talk about passwords and specifically expiry of passwords. You know, how often have you been, you know, trying to get something done and you go and try and log in and somebody says, oh, your password's expired.
Oh, it's the worst.
Yeah. It's not fun. It's not fun.
No.
And, you know, there's already enough sort of cultural angst about the security role in a business. Yeah. You know, you don't really need a lot more. So, you know, we've still got this little quirk, you know, where people are forced to change their passwords every once in a while. And I think the standard typically has been, you know, 90 days quite often, sometimes in more secure organizations more frequently. But, you know, the whole point of forcing somebody to change their password is ideally to sort of reduce the risk that if a password has been stolen in an attack or accidental breach, that, you know, you change it every once in a while and it won't be usable. But I guess the question, you know, that comes out at this time when we're looking at this particular story is how effective is that as a method of reducing risk, you know, to force somebody to change passwords? And are there, you know, other consequences of forcing people to change passwords fairly frequently, right? And when you think about it, you know, if you change your password and then you forget your password that you just changed. Then you got to go back through the process of recovery. And sometimes they will let you change it back to what it was before. And so in the end, it doesn't really make a huge difference because a lot of people will go back and use the same password. On the other hand, if you're getting people to be good citizens and they're changing their passwords to something different, now they've got the problem of remembering them all if they're not using a password manager. And a lot of businesses have not yet formally adopted password managers, which is, I think, a problem too. That's sort of a secondary thing around this. But, you know, I think the point is the real recommendations, I think, from NIST, the National Institute for Science and Standards Technology. And Technology, they had changed the rules or the recommendations several years ago, right? So they were saying use longer passwords, less complex, and you shouldn't need to force them to be changed, right? I think that was in the most recent guidance. But a lot of organizations and a lot of regulatory frameworks haven't actually adopted that yet. And so we're still a bit of a mess, right?
Yeah, it's a total mess. Yeah. And I like the fact, too, that and they point out in this article that if you already have a secure password, why would you need to change it if it follows, you know, complexity guidelines and things like that? And especially if we're encouraging employees to use passphrases and a password manager.
Yeah.
And if you have two-factor authentication on top of that, right, and so on and so on, those password change policies really can just just die.
Yeah, there's an interesting sort of analogy or parallel to, you know, credit cards, right? So when a credit card number gets stolen, there's only a certain amount of time before you discover it and you change it, right? So most of the times when it comes to passwords, if people have seen a breach, or usually it's the website that's been compromised, right, finds out there's been a breach, and they tell people, change your password. So attackers, I think, are pretty well attuned to the fact that they have to use that password pretty soon after it's been stolen. You know, stale passwords probably aren't worth as much as more recently stolen ones. And so it doesn't really make sense that, you know, some 60 days later, I'm going to change my password, you know, because the guy's already probably used it if he's stolen it, you know. So that's the main point I think we want to get across. So, all that to say, you know, I think we all have struggles with the passwords, but let's try and make it a little bit more reasonable for employees. If you're in a security role in an organization, maybe you don't need to have password resets every 90 days if you do have good, strong passwords and you do tell people to change them when there is a breach or some known compromise of their password. So that's the basics, right? So this story was brought to you by ClickArmor, the first fully gamified security awareness training and engagement platform. And you might have noticed recently I've been on a little bit of a tear with my LinkedIn posts around the top reasons why live phishing tests suck.
I love it.
So,
yeah.
So, I mean, I've been dancing around it for a couple of years, you know, hinting that maybe there's a better way, but I think people just need more of a straight up revelation. And, can you guess, Tom, how many ways in which I've identified live phishing tests suck?
More than one.
More than one. More than 15.
Wow, 15? That's a lot.
I'm posting one a day this Security Awareness Month. I'm posting one a day. So I might even have 20. I might have enough to go the whole month.
Wow, they really do suck.
A different way that live phishing tests suck. So if you don't want your security awareness program to suck, I recommend check out ClickArmor.
So our last story, this was on KrebsSecurity.com, which Brian Krebs, we always love his stuff. But there's a big problem going on with LinkedIn lately, and that is with fake profiles and bots infiltrating this social network. I mean, we've talked for years about bots and fake profiles on all the social networks.
Yes.
And if Kevin was here, I would joke.
Social zombies.
Yes. That most of those profiles belong to Kevin, but he is not here, unfortunately, but I'll say it anyway. Because that was the joke. It's like, oh, all these profiles on LinkedIn, they must be Kevin's. But yeah, this is a big problem. In fact, in the article, they talked about this group in LinkedIn called Sustainability Professionals. They have over 300,000 members. And one of the group's owners has said that he's blocked over 12,000 suspected fake profiles so far this year. And it's fascinating to me. And the difference, what they're finding in this article, we'll link in the show notes, you can read more about it. But they're using those AI apps that generate pictures, profile pictures. I think we talked about that one on the show before.
Yeah.
It was that this person is not real.com or something like that, which you can keep refreshing the page and it'll show you a profile picture of created through AI. Essentially, of somebody.
Wow.
And they have automated this to create very realistic. And if you look at some of these profiles, these are all executives. They're all, you know, high level, C-level type of individuals. They look very believable. And it'd be very difficult at first glance to see, yep, that's a fake profile on LinkedIn. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I've seen them myself, obviously. I get a lot of LinkedIn requests for connection. And sometimes they're just salespeople, right? And you can detect that.
Sure. But
there are some that are pretty obviously just fakes, right? For whether it's just the topic that they're raising or the bad grammar in their inquiry. But I think it's important to check, you know, the networks that these people belong to, right? I mean, you should be able to see a lot of mutual connections, you know, if it's somebody you don't know, and you should be able to reach out to your potential mutual connections and say, do you really know this person? So, or in most cases like mine, I don't bother. I just ignore them.
Yeah. Yeah. There's, It's interesting, too, just to see what they were talking about in this article about. No one really knows what the purpose yet of all of these fake profiles are, because they haven't been doing anything, right? So that there's one example of, you know, someone tried to interact with them through a message and there was no response. Yeah. So a lot of people are suggesting that they're kind of bots in waiting, if you will, for orders. You know, most likely, I think Mandiant, the cybersecurity firm now owned by Google, had said that they're potentially maybe used by, like, say, North Korea to send crypto scams, cryptocurrency scams, and other types of things, or the term called pig butchering scams, which that's actually a pretty new term.
Sounds gross. Yeah, I never heard of that
before. For fake profiles where, you know, flirtatious strangers, right, are luring usually men to click links and other types of things related to cryptocurrency. But yeah, interesting nonetheless. And it's just fascinating to me that seeing that, you know, LinkedIn has a big problem with this. In fact, like all social networks do, but doesn't seem like LinkedIn right now is getting a good handle on it with so many of these fake profiles. So there's some suggestions too of, you know, what LinkedIn could do. One of those examples was looking at the creation date of the profile.
Yeah.
So new profiles, obviously, that have, you know, a filled out profile and they look pretty realistic, that might be an indicator to somebody that that's probably a fake profile, right? If it was just created yesterday. Yeah. And those types of things. But
do you believe the statement from LinkedIn that says they stop around 96% of fake
accounts? I don't know. It's kind of like how Twitter says they don't have a bot problem, and you know, Elon Musk calling them out on, you know, less than 5%, I think was the number, right? And I would say that's much greater than 5% on Twitter as well.
But it doesn't seem like it would be that hard, like you said, for LinkedIn to clamp down on some of this stuff. So
yeah,
I guess it's so. Their, you know, aggressiveness on trying to grow the platform, the membership. Right.
So, you know, the old adage, you know, like we've talked about on the show and the advice that we give people, you know, you should really only be accepting requests from people that you know, or people that you have interacted with or done business with on LinkedIn. Be very, very careful just accepting those requests from just random people that message you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're really, you know, wanting to have some kind of a formula for who you do or don't accept, you know, like I said, a lot of people that I will see invites from or have, you know, a handful of connections, right? You just, like, what's the value in connecting with somebody that has so few or a dozen or so, right? I mean, unless you do know them and you're trying to help them out building their network, then yeah, don't accept those. I mean, I don't have a problem accepting requests from people that have 10,000 followers or whatever, right? Because it's pretty hard to create a fake profile that has 10,000 followers.
Yeah. Manually.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Maybe someday the AI will do it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. These profile pictures too are pretty, realistic. Those AI generated profile pics are, they're good. I mean, they are really good. So it's interesting to see how bots have evolved to take advantage of new technology like that. It's fascinating. Yeah.
The whole AI image and video thing is probably a topic for another program. But
yes,
I was watching a British TV show called The Capture.
No, I haven't
heard of it. Heard of it.
No.
It's really heavily themed around the problem of deep fakes and UK law enforcement stuff like that, and intelligence.
Cool.
And how, like, real-time deep fakes. It's pretty cool.
Check that out. All right, Scott. Well, I think that's all we have time for today. One last shout out I wanted to give was to our sponsor, Silent, which I'm wearing their hat.
Oh, there you go.
So we've been doing a lot more collaboration. At least I've been doing a lot more collaboration with Silent. There's more things that we have in the works as well, especially around the holidays. You might see another contest pop up for free Faraday gear.
There we go.
Which they are known for. So just don't forget that if you'd like to purchase any of their fine quality products, you could do so by going to silent.com and use discount code shared security to take 10% off your order. Love those guys. Yeah. Love their products. They've been a long time supporter of the show. So definitely check them out.
Excellent. And we thank them.
Yes. And with that, that is all for this week's show. But thank you, Scott, for co-hosting.
Thank you, Tom, for doing the awesome job you do every week on hosting.
So. You're welcome. We hope Kevin feels better.
Yeah.
And we will talk to all of you again next week. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, subscribe on your favorite podcast listening app, or leave us a rating and review. To catch all the latest from the show, visit our website, sharedsecurity.net, for all show notes and previous episodes. Follow us on Twitter at SharedSec, and join our Reddit community on the Shared Security Show subreddit. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week for another episode of the Shared Security Show.